I had a very interesting conversation with a woman on the phone the other day at work. So she first asked about endocrinology books, and I had to disappoint her by saying we had just Mormon titles. And then she said, oh, well, you should have something about Mormons in Europe then. Knowing that was going to be kind of a broad topic, I asked some follow-up questions. Turns out she thought Mormonism began in Europe. She was absolutely shocked to learn it started here in the United States. The phrase, how did I not know this before, was thrown around very liberally. You're telling me that Mormons, Joseph Smith, Book of Mormon, that all began in New York? Yep, it did. But it didn't stay there for long.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
We've talked about some of the seminal events of early Mormonism. The Smith family upbringing, Joseph Smith's first visions, the Book of Mormon. All of this took place while they lived in New York State. The movement was still pretty loose through this period, occasional meetings, but not really a sense of community yet. As the message of Joseph Smith, angels, and the Book of Mormon spread, branches developed in South Central New York. Some of them would have an identity that would follow them for years, such as the Colesville branch. Then the seeds of big changes were planted in a September 1830 revelation. Think back for a minute to our discussion of Oliver Cowdery and his commanding Joseph Smith to change a revelation. And then Hiram Page started getting revelations with the seer stone. Do you remember all of this in previous episodes? The solution was to have Oliver take Hiram, his brother-in-law, aside and straighten him out. Well, the revelation also foreshadowed a life-altering transition. The text of the revelation, which is now Doctrine and Covenants 28 in Mormon scripture, commanded Oliver the following quote. Behold, I say unto you that thou shalt go unto the Lamanites and preach my gospel unto them and cause my church to be established among them. And thou shalt have revelations, but write them not by the way of commandment. And now behold, I say unto you that it is not revealed, and no man knoweth where the city shall be built, but it shall be given hereafter. End quote. So that's the Lord talking to Joseph Smith, and apparently even Jesus appreciates the value of a good teaser.
It seems like this teaser was also kind of a clapback at Hiram Page. His revelations were building to a point where it seems like he was about to tell people where the New Jerusalem would be built, which was a big topic of discussion. A month after the revelation, Cowdery and three others, including his brother-in-law, Peter Whitmer Jr., and then two new converts, Harley P. Pratt and Ziba Peterson, set off to the west on a mission to the, quote, Lamanites. Before leaving, they all signed this contract, quote, to go forth unto the Lamanites, to proclaim glad tidings of great joy unto them, by presenting unto them the fullness of the gospel of the only begotten Son of God, and also to rear up a pillar as a witness where the temple of God shall be built, in the glorious New Jerusalem. Obviously, with no Mr. Mack around at the time, outfitting these missionaries is going to be a little bit more complicated. In her memoirs, Lucy Mack Smith noted, quote, as soon as this revelation was received, Emma Smith and several other sisters began to make arrangements to furnish those who were set apart for this mission with the necessary clothing, which was no easy task, as the most of it had to be manufactured out of the raw material. Emma's health at this time was quite delicate, yet she did not favor herself on this account. But whatever her hands found to do, she did with her might, until she went so far beyond her strength that she brought upon herself a heavy fit of sickness, which lasted 4 weeks.
Mm-mm.
This missionary journey that the church would go on would be actually responsible for creating sort of a two-headed church. How so? Though one of the stated purposes for the trip was to convert Lamanites, which early Mormons and a lot of Mormons today still see as Native Americans, little to none of this actually happened. The doctrine wasn't really compelling to American Indians at the time. However, their first major stops in Ohio, where they visit a friend of Parley P. Pratt named Sidney Rigdon, turned out to be a little bit more prosperous. Rigdon had brought Pratt into the Disciples of Christ movement, and I think we've talked about Rigdon before. He was a man of many churches. He liked clinging on to different movements. So Parley P. Pratt comes, Rigdon brings him into the Disciples of Christ movement, which was a seeker group looking for a restoration of the charismatic New Testament-style Christianity, not unique to Mormonism. Pratt figured it was only fair now to inform Rigdon that he had found the real McCoy in Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. Finally, they found the guy. Before long, the missionaries had baptized more than 100 people and set up a group in Ohio. So think about it. The missionaries go out to convert Lamanites. Instead, they meet Sidney Rigdon, and he basically takes his whole congregation with them. That's a good score if you're a missionary. This episode was absolutely crucial to the health of the Mormon movement. Because in addition to Rigdon, listen to who else joins up from the Disciples of Christ. Some big names if you know Mormon history. Lyman White, Isaac Morley, John Murdoch, Orson Hyde, Edward Partridge, Newell K. Whitney, and all of their families. All at once, a core of influential future leaders is created, but they are hundreds of miles away from Joseph Smith.
After this month of activity that would make any LDS missionary who served in, say, Paris very jealous, we now have this branch located in Kirtland, Ohio. At the same time, the missionary group takes off down the road into Missouri. However, back in Ohio, this new convert, Sidney Rigdon, really wanted to meet Joseph Smith, so he and a couple others go back to New York, where he quickly becomes Smith's right-hand man. Then, in January 1831, at a church conference, a revelation is given, which repeats instructions that they had heard privately a month before, that commanded the Mormons to, quote, go to the Ohio. However, Ohio is not the New Jerusalem. We're still looking for that. Now back in Missouri, Cowdery and Company did not have a whole lot of success there. Again, their stated mission, they tried to preach to some Native American tribes there, but since they lacked a permit that allowed them to actually be there, they get booted out. They did make a few converts among the white settlers, but it was absolutely nothing like their great experience they'd had in Ohio.
And now let's see what Mormon scholar Christina Rossetti has to say about the religious landscape of New York at the time.
My name is Christina Rossetti. I have a PhD in religious studies from the University of California, Riverside, and I specialize in Mormon fundamentalism.
So in his book, Awash in a Sea of Faith, John Butler talks a lot about how the Book of Mormon sacralized the American landscape, and not just the American landscape, but the New York landscape specifically, because the gold plates were dug out of the ground and the ground of the Hill Cumorah. But just as much as the Book of Mormon sacralized the American landscape, a lot of the American landscape was really imparted into the Book of Mormon and really transformed Mormonism in general. And we can really see a lot of the New York context within the Book of Mormon and what became Mormonism. At the time that the Book of Mormon came into existence and that Joseph Smith began Mormonism, the world of New York was undergoing big changes in terms of religion. New York is often referred to as the burnt over district during the 19th century because it was a time of religious fervor and religious revival. A lot of scholars refer to it as the Second Great Awakening. There's a really great book written about the time by Nathan O. Hatch called The Democratization of American Christianity. And he talks about the American Revolution to 1845 and the changes that happened in the American context that really influenced religion. And this isn't just true of Mormonism. His book is about American Christianity generally, but there's a few things that are worth noting when he talks about American Christianity and how it underwent change. So at the time, there was a resurgence of democratic ideals, specifically Jeffersonian democracy. And we really see that in Mormonism. Anyone could have a religious experience. Religious experiences were largely individual. And we see that in Mormonism. Joseph Smith was just a normal guy who had an individual religious experience with the divine that not only transformed his life, but transformed United States religion in the United States. And this was really heavily influenced by the anti-clericalism in the United States at the time. Mormonism really proudly states that it is a religion that has a lay clergy. And that really reflects the anti-clerical ideals at the time and the belief that anyone could have religious experience. At the time, women were having visions and were talking to God. This was the rise of the Black Church. So anyone was able to have experiences. This was also a time where common sense moral reasoning really became popular in the United States. And we see that in the Book of Mormon. Mormonism is a largely rational religion. And what I mean by that isn't so much that there isn't any feeling or emotionalism to it, but so often we hear Mormons talk about knowing that the church is true, knowing that there is a divine entity, and kind of having a rational faith about things. And this was something that was really popular in the 19th century, was a rational approach to religion that wasn't as emotional as previous. Mormonism, of course, is a millennial religion. Mormons are called the Churches of Christ of Latter-day Saints. The Millerites were doing this at the time, the Shakers, the Quakers. The 19th century religion was really focused on the end, and that the end was imminent. Mormonism is an orderly religion. It has a very structural clergy of a first presidency, of a quorum of apostles, of multiple levels of 70s. It was kind of a alternative to the romantic ideals of the romantic era, and it presented a more structuralist approach to religion. And one of the big things that I think is worth noting is during the 19th century, especially 19th century New York, there was a big focus on anti-Calvinist determinism. Now, Calvinism was a religious ideology that John Calvin started during the Reformation, where he had a really deterministic and negative view of humanity. And Mormonism is really optimistic about human beings. The Book of Mormon makes humans, the fall isn't bad. The fall is something that made humans able to leave the garden and progress. They're able to eternally progress. And that's really different from the Calvinist ideas at the time. And so taken together, these things kind of show that Mormonism didn't only impact the United States, but the United States 19th century context really impacted Mormonism. And Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon, and Mormonism in general was significantly impacted by what New York was doing at the time, and that the Book of Mormon was dug out of the ground of a burnt-over landscape.
So why leave New York in the first place? There seems to be three main factors. First, in a development that would be repeated everywhere Mormons went, Joseph Smith and his grandiose, expansive ideas sort of ticked off his neighbors. At a baptism service in June 1830, disgruntled locals tried to interrupt, tipped over wagons, and caused havoc. A trial accusing Joseph Smith of being a disorderly person for apparently, quote, setting the country in an uproar by preaching the Book of Mormon takes place at this time. He was a bit of a controversial figure. It also seems that Joseph Smith saw Masons behind conspiracies that would harm the Mormons. It made sense. His neighbors were out to get him. Why not the Masons, too? A letter to Hiram Smith during this period tells him twice to, quote, beware of the Freemasons, which is something my grandmother would always say, too. Just kidding. A January 1831 revelation warns about, quote, a thing which is had in secret chambers to bring to pass even your destruction in process of time, end quote. We got a little Gadiant and robbers rhetoric going on, which in the Book of Mormon is secret groups that conspire against the will of God. Joseph saw this in his neighbors and his Freemason friends. Frenemies. Even after Joseph Smith was settled in Kirtland, he would continue to warn folks back in New York about these, quote, secret combinations. And secondly, there were probably some mounting debts that were happening in New York. When Joseph Smith came back to New York from Pennsylvania, he left a debt due to his father-in-law, Isaac Hale. In New York, court action was taken against Joseph's brother, Hiram, and a judgment was issued. Wherever these Smith boys went, they were starting to collect legal trouble really quick. In a separate incident, judgment comes calling to the Smith household looking for Hiram and searching the house when William Smith does his best Donatello impression using a handspike for his bow staff and chase the men out. No, that really happened. Joseph Smith Sr. spent a month in debtor's prison also. It seems that despite this, the Smith's parents were reluctant to move again. Moving was hard. We talked about this on the frontier. Given how many times they had picked up and started over, that's pretty understandable.
Third factor, Joseph Smith, back in New York, is getting reports that Kirtland is getting just a little bit too groovy down there. We talked a little bit about this in our Bad Girls episode, and it's a predictable setup. You've got a new religion with boundaries and norms that are still in flux, You've got diverse religious backgrounds, some organized, some folk religions, and not really a recognized leader on the ground. Bad combination here. Now, remember also the largest religious context. Organized religion is taking a beating at this time. People are really getting sick of these Jonathan Edwards types constantly damning them to hell in God's angry hands. Gets tiring after a while. So these various seeker movements are trying to get people to have their own connection to God, and this often comes out in enthusiastic, charismatic ways. Trying to corral this within the fence of organized, structured church, it's a rocky process. John Whitmer describes some of the more colorful expressions in Kirtland, quote, "Some had visions and could not tell what they saw. Some would fancy to themselves that they had the sword of Laban and would wield it as expert as a light dragoon. Some would act like an Indian in the act of scalping. Some would slide or scoot and on the floor with the rapidity of a serpent, which they termed sailing in the boat to the Lamanites preaching the gospel, and many other vain and foolish maneuvers that are unseeming and unprofitable to mention."
Yeah, this is something that's super interesting that we don't talk a lot about, but this idea of Western expansion really permeates early Mormonism. They inform each other. And the term has been coined playing Indian, right? And here we have this. You have whole congregations who are left with the Book of Mormon. Whole congregations who are left with this Book of Mormon, and then these like elder missionaries jet back to home base, and they leave these congregations with this scripture. And you've got all this religious fervor with no structure. So you have whole congregations performing these plays from their scripture of these ancient, quote, Native Americans, Lamanites, and they're, you know, mimicking scalpings and any sort of white idea of what a Native American looked or acted like is what they were doing in the name of religion. It was kind of bananas.
It's a great connection. And one of our more colorful figures that we'll see later on, William McCary, creates a whole cottage industry around this with his wife of quote unquote playing Indian. So not surprising, it's happening even earlier on.
Hey, Sunstone Mormon History Podcast listeners. This is Christopher C. Smith, historian of Mormonism, back to talk to you about the ecstatic manifestations at Kirtland in which people acted out various kinds of Lamanite behaviors. I'm really excited about this. This is my jam. It's not every day that I get to plug my own published research, partly because while I'm good at making discoveries, I'm not that good at actually getting it down on paper and published in a real-world academic journal, but this particular topic I have published on, I published an article titled Playing Lamanite, Ecstatic Performance of American Indian Roles in Early Mormon Ohio. I'll make sure that a link to that gets into the show notes for the episode if you would like to read it. And you can also find a link to that on my personal website, ChristopherCarrollSmith.com. Christopher spelled with a PH and Carol with two R's and two L's. And by the way, folks, I have a cold this week, so if my voice sounds a little bit nasally, I apologize in advance. So for me, this story really starts with Parley P. Pratt. Parley P. Pratt lives in Lorain County, Ohio, where he's got a farm, which he's purchased on credit, and he's built this cabin for his young bride, Thankful. And he, in 1829, hears a Baptist preacher named Sidney Rigdon preach. And Rigdon is basically the leader of two different religious communities. One in Kirtland, Ohio, is called the Family. And the Family is essentially a Christian socialist commune. So the book of Acts in Acts chapter 2 says that the disciples and the New Testament church had all things in common. And it seems to mean that they shared their property amongst themselves equally and that nobody really owned any private property that was exclusively their own. Everything was shared. And the Morley family and other Christian socialists of the time took this as a model that the modern church is supposed to follow the example of the early church in having all things in common. So the Morley family is doing this. They're putting all their property into a pot and they're sharing it among the community. And the other community that Sidney Rigdon is in charge of is a Baptist congregation in Mentor, Ohio, which is near Kirtland. And he is a Campbellite or Disciples of Christ Baptist. And they're really a kind of oriented toward biblical theology. They've distilled the gospel down to what they call the five fingers. They'll hold up their five fingers and they'll tick these off as a proselytizing or evangelism technique. The five fingers are faith, repentance, baptism, remission of sins, and the gift of the Holy Spirit. And this is what Pratt really gets excited about, is this simple, intuitive distillation of the ancient gospel. And the only reservation that he has about it is that the gift of the Holy Spirit, even though they sort of pay lip service to it, they're not like practicing the spiritual gifts described in the New Testament, like the gifts of healing, the gifts of tongues, gifts of miracles. These things don't really seem to be evident in that community, but it's not enough a reservation to dampen his excitement. He's so excited about this. He reads in the book of Matthew that you are supposed to forsake your family and your possessions in order to follow Jesus and preach the gospel. And so he decides that that is what he is called to do. He sells his farm and leaves the area. And actually, he's got so many bad debts that his creditors are pursuing him. They send the constable after him. And he actually has to run to get away from the constable. He manages to do that. So this, in addition to being spiritually liberating, I'm sure is kind of financially liberating for him, because he's escaping all of these bad debts that he's accumulated owning this really unproductive farm in Lorain County. But anyway, he and his wife, thankful, get on a boat and head up on Lake Erie and up the Erie Canal. They're heading to Albany. And at Rochester, New York, he feels impressed. He feels a spiritual impression to leave Thankful on the boat. He sends her on ahead to meet up with his aunt in Albany. And he heads out into the New York countryside to preach this gospel that he's discovered as part of the Campbellite movement. And at his first preaching engagement, he's given a copy of the Book of Mormon. And he spends the next day just reading the entire book. And it is so fascinating to him. He is skipping sleep and skipping meals. He is so compelled by this book, so moved by it. And the things that he finds so exciting are, number one, the restoration of apostolic power that the Book of Mormon promises. The Book of Mormon talks about all of those gifts that he thinks are absent from the Campbellite movement, the healing, the speaking in tongues. And by the way, when I talk about speaking in tongues, in the early Christian church and in early Mormonism, the gift of tongues was an instantaneous power to speak in a language that you had never learned or never studied before. You could speak to people in their own languages and be understood by them. You could speak in angelic languages in worship and prayer. So this is basically something where, as an act of worship or as an act of proselytism, you are speaking in something that sounds to you like gibberish, but to a speaker of whatever language you're being miraculously empowered to speak, they would understand what you're saying. So he's thrilled by that. The other thing he's really excited about is the Book of Mormon's teaching that the American Indians are Christ's other sheep. Christ says in the New Testament, "I have other sheep that you don't know about." And Joseph Smith teaches that these are the American Indians. Parley Pratt gets really excited about that. Joseph Smith is also teaching the Indians are a remnant of Israel, and Israel is finally going to be restored in fulfillment of biblical prophecies in Isaiah and in the Old Testament. And Israel had been missing for so long, it had sort of ceased to exist. And people really wondered, Christians in the 19th century really wondered how these prophecies of the restoration of Israel were going to be fulfilled now that Israel seemed to no longer exist. The Mormons understand the American Indians to be a remnant of Israel. And this is how Israel is going to be restored. We are going to proselytize them. They're going to be converted to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And they're going to be restored to their lands and all the promises in the Bible and civilized. And they're going to be like gloriously inhabit the New Jerusalem with converted white Mormons. So this is really exciting to Parley Pratt. He's super thrilled about this. He decides he needs to go and meet Joseph Smith. So he goes to Palmyra. He meets Hiram Smith. Hiram Smith goes on to introduce him to Joseph Smith. And Parley Pratt tells Joseph, you know, what it is about the movement that so compelled him, what he's so excited about. And I think really Parley Pratt catalyzes Joseph Smith to finally take action on this Lamanite thing. And Joseph Smith sends four men, including Parley Pratt and Oliver Cowdery, as missionaries to Indian territory in Kansas. both to preach to the Lamanites and begin converting them in fulfillment of these Book of Mormon prophecies, and to select a site for the Mormon New Jerusalem or City of Zion. And really, another important fact to know is that in the original revelation that became DNC 28, the site for the City of Zion was said to be among the Lamanites. They were supposed to go to Kansas and choose a site for the New Jerusalem in Indian territory among the Lamanites. And then later, when they actually go to Kansas and they preach to the Indians, a government Indian agent finds that there are these unlicensed preachers in Indian territory, and he kicks them out. And they actually apply for a license to preach to the Indians and are denied. And so they aren't able to choose a site for the New Jerusalem in Indian territory. And so they have to settle for a site across the river in Jackson County, Missouri. And that is why the Mormons settle at Independence, Missouri, rather than in Kansas, which at that time was Indian territory. And that revelation that becomes DNC 28 actually gets revised. In the modern Doctrine and Covenants, it reads that the City of Zion will be in, it will be on the border by the Lamanites. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. The missionaries en route to Kansas, as they're heading west, stop in Kirtland, which is where Parley Pratt is from, and Parley Pratt introduces these missionaries to Sidney Rigdon and also to the leaders of the Morley family commune, Lyman White and Isaac Morley. And those men convert to the LDS Church and accept baptism from these Mormonite missionaries. The Mormonites preach to thousands of people while they're in the area, and these communities that Sidney Rigdon and these other men led almost wholesale convert to the Mormonite gospel. 127 people get baptized while the missionaries are there, and they preach to thousands of people. They're there for about 3 weeks, and they preach several things. They preach that the Indians are going to be converted in fulfillment of prophecy. They preach that the Indians are a part of the ancient Israelite tribe of Manasseh, whose ancestors landed on the coast of Chile 600 years before the coming of Christ. This is according to newspaper accounts at the time. The newspapers say that Oliver Cowdery taught that the Book of Mormon was especially addressed to the Lamanites, and that as fast as they converted, they were going to be transformed into white men. The Book of Mormon teaches that Lamanite skin color is going to be turned white. Another newspaper says that Cowdery described the Book of Mormon promises that the Indians would become a white and delightsome people and be reinstated in possession of their lands, of which they had been despoiled by the whites. So he's actually kind of taking the Indian side in the land disputes between whites and natives, which is really interesting. And also that he predicted that the world would come to an end in 2 or 3 years, and that they were going to build a city of refuge in Indian territory. And Samuel F. Whitney says that they went so far as to teach that Lamanites in 3 years would come and help the Mormons exterminate the Gentiles, and blood would flow in the streets. So pretty radical messages for the time. You can see why people found the Mormonite message kind of threatening these white people, because the Mormonites are predicting that Lamanites are going to wipe out the Gentiles. The Mormons also say, Oliver Cowdery and Parley P. Pratt are quoted as having said that they were going to be empowered by the gift of tongues to preach to Lamanites in their own languages, and the Lamanites were going to be able to understand what they said. So they're talking about the gift of tongues while they're in Kirtland. I don't think they're practicing the gift of tongues while they're there. Maybe they are. I don't know. We don't have any direct accounts of the missionaries practicing the gift of tongues. But certainly after they leave at the end of these 3 weeks, people start practicing the gift of tongues. While they're there, they do attempt a couple of healings. Newspaper reports say that they tried to heal a girl who had been bedridden for 2 years. Prayed over her, laid on hands, and commanded her in the name of Jesus Christ to rise up and walk. She was unable to do that. And also that Cowdery prayed for a man dying of tuberculosis. And Sidney Rigdon declared that the dying man would get well if there was a God in heaven, but the man shortly after died. And so they have some failures, but Rigdon explains these as like, you're not supposed to search for signs. The Bible forbids you to ask for signs. And so Rigdon thinks that that's why these miracles failed, these attempted healings failed, is that they were seeking for signs rather than acting out of a genuine faith and belief that God would heal these people. But these attempts at healing reveal sort of the expectations that they come with. And after the missionaries leave, things get really charismatic, really spiritual in Kirtland. People start doing all kinds of spiritual manifestations. And the chief among those is the gift of tongues. It seems to have started with Lyman White. Lyman White is ordained while the missionaries are there. And after they leave, he sort of becomes a leader of this movement. The missionaries have left this movement kind of without any Books of Mormon, without any authorities. They've just kind of baptized them and then moved on. So the movement is sort of left to kind of find their own authorities. And I think they find them in large part in these charismatic manifestations. So Lyman White, during a meeting one night, has the power of God fall upon him, and his face and hands shine so that everyone in the room can see. And he sings a song that no one has heard before, which they said was the most melodious that they had ever listened to, and it was sung in another tongue. And this seems to kind of begin the manifestations. They don't describe Lyman White as having spoken in an Indian tongue, but a lot of other people start to speak in Indian tongues, and especially young men and young women. The principal participants in this included a black man named Black Pete, who was a prominent member of the movement at the time, and also an indentured servant named Heman Bassett, and a couple of women. There was 14-year-old Lucy Stanton and 20-year-old Minerva Whitlock, and then a couple more sort of middle-class participants, Edson Fuller, who was a carpenter, and Burr Riggs, who was the son of a hotel owner. So, but, you know, apart from those two sort of middle-class guys, most of the participants in these manifestations are sort of lower-class people. They're either women, or they're black, or they're an indentured servant. And so it's interesting that their manifestations have this sort of social leveling effect where they're sort of exalting Lamanites, playing these interesting roles that imply a kind of leveling of racial hierarchies. There's also kind of an interesting gender dynamic where when the women speak in Indian tongues, you know, often they will be laid on beds, whereas the men do a lot more kind of active maneuvers and running around and stuff. But the women sometimes participate in the running as well, and the neighbors quite disgustedly describe how when Black Pete would run over the hills during these charismatic manifestations, he would be chased by white women. And so there is kind of like a subversion of patriarchal norms there, where women are supposed to be more passive and men are supposed to be more active. Sometimes the women are engaging in really active kinds of behaviors. And also there's a subversion of racial norms there that the neighbors react quite negatively to, where white women are engaging in what they call promiscuous behavior with this black man. So the neighbors find that really threatening as well. This implicit subversion of gender norms and of racial hierarchies. But basically, these ecstatic manifestations fall into two categories. And I think it all kind of starts with the gift of tongues. People understand themselves to be speaking in Lamanite tongues, and they're elaborating on that with kind of stereotyped Indian gestures. But they take on kind of two different interpretations. So the first one is that the manifestations are portraying the conversion, proselytism and conversion of the Lamanites in faraway Indian territory where the missionaries have gone. So this community in Kirtland is seeing in vision what is happening in Indian territory, or at least what they imagine is happening in Indian territory with the mass conversion of Lamanites to Mormonism. When they're preaching in Indian tongues, they are preaching to imaginary Indian audiences. And neighbors describe how they would get up onto stumps late at night, and they would loudly preach in Indian tongues to imaginary Indian audiences. And the neighbors kind of angrily describe how they're waking up at all hours of the night because they're hearing these harangues outside their windows. And also, the people are sometimes getting down on the floor and wriggling in a serpentine fashion, saying that they are sailing on the boat to the Lamanites, you know, like they're rowing in canoes to the Lamanites. And they're occasionally even going down into the waters of baptism with like planks. The planks represent Lamanite converts, and they'll dunk these planks and perform the ceremony of baptism in imitation, again, of what they think is happening in Indian territory. So that's the first category. And then the second category is Lamanite violence. So they will act out scalping or disemboweling or tomahawking opponents. They seem to understand this as an embodiment of the apocalyptic violence that's coming. So the Lamanites at the end of time are going to wipe out the unconverted white Americans. Any white person who doesn't join Mormonism is going to be destroyed in this Indian apocalypse where the Lamanites are restored to their glory, restored to the New Jerusalem, and destroy the unconverted. So there's some interesting stuff happening here. There's an implicit racial hierarchy. In the proselytism manifestations, these performers are performing white roles, converting the Lamanites. So that places white people, white Mormons anyway, in a superior position to the Lamanites. But on the other hand, the manifestations about Lamanite violence are placing the Lamanites in a superior position to the unconverted white people. You have both a reinforcement of racial hierarchy with the white Mormons still above the Lamanites, but also a subversion in the sense that the white Protestants are now below the Lamanites on the racial hierarchy. So there's both like a reinforcement of social hierarchy and a disruption of social hierarchy here, depending on the perspective that you look at it from. The neighbors, as I've mentioned, are fairly threatened or at least fairly disgusted by these subversions of hierarchy. But I think they're not that worried about it because Ohio at the time doesn't have a large Indian population. But when Mormons later go to Missouri, this takes on a more threatening aspect. People in Missouri, these Indian manifestations happen in Missouri as well. There's prophecies that the Indians are going to destroy the whites there. People are speaking in Indian tongues there and, you know, receiving interpretations. Rumors fly around in Independence, Missouri, that the Mormons are forming an alliance with the Indians, that they're going to rile the Indians up to destroy the whites. And on one occasion, armed men flood the streets because they're afraid that this is happening now. The Mormons are, you know, invading with Indians now. And so they flood the streets. And when they finally kick the Mormons out of Missouri, I think a lot of it is racial anxiety, both around the threat that Mormons are going to rile up the Indians, but also around the threat of African Americans, you know, the participation of people like Black Pete, and the fact that the Mormons are all Yankees, whereas the Missourians are mostly from the South. The Missourians see the Mormons as a threat. They're afraid that the Mormons are going to invite a bunch of free blacks to Missouri and disrupt the slave system there and turn Missouri into a free state rather than a slave state, and possibly even rile up their own slaves to revolt against them. Slave rebellions had been an occasional threat to slave owners during this period. And so these Missourians were really afraid of the Mormons. And the Mormons had printed a few things that were kind of in favor of free blacks, but they end up actually printing retractions in order to mollify these angry Missourians. It doesn't really work. And the Mormons, of course, get kicked out of county after county in Missouri. And a lot of it has to do with these racial anxieties because of the charismatic manifestations that seem to be disrupting traditional racial hierarchies. So even though there are some aspects in which, you know, racial and gender hierarchies are being reinforced here, there's enough disruption that it's really upsetting the established order and creating a lot of anxiety in their neighbors. And this actually is a really common thing with charismatic movements. Movements that have, you know, spiritual gifts where anybody can speak with the authority of God and you're afraid to question that, right? So they're often liberating for people in disadvantaged groups like women or people in disadvantaged racial groups. When the Azusa Street Revival, which is the beginning of the Pentecostal movement, happens, there's a lot of black and white kind of mixing, race mixing in the Azusa Street Mission, basically because black people are speaking with the power of God and white people don't feel authorized to say, no, that isn't the power of God. And so it's this wonderful moment where racial boundaries are broken down and everybody is kind of brought together by the power of the Holy Spirit. But then what happens in these charismatic movements is that as time goes on, authority is sort of reestablished. The old order sets rules around who can engage in charismatic gifts and who can't, and sets rules around the authorities being able to either authorize or to refute charismatic manifestations. And that happens very quickly in Mormonism. So these manifestations really only happen at Kirtland for a brief moment in time in 1831, the end of 1830, early 1831. And then Joseph Smith shows up at Kirtland and he publishes a DNC 50, which rebukes the community for receiving spirits that they didn't understand. And I think that's a reference to the gift of tongues. He's kind of shutting down the gift of tongues in Kirtland. And after that, the gift of tongues isn't practiced in Kirtland until 1832, when Brigham Young arrives. And he arrives from New York and very quickly speaks in tongues. And everybody's sort of waiting for Joseph Smith to shut him down. But actually, Joseph Smith doesn't shut him down. Joseph Smith says, no, that was of God. But he interprets it as Adamic tongues, the language that Adam and Eve spoke in the Garden of Eden, rather than as Indian or Lamanite tongues. And from then on, I think he's much more interested in the primordial mythology of Adam and Eve than he is in telling stories about Nephites and Lamanites. And I think a lot of that is to kind of allay these racial anxieties that some of the neighbors have. Black Pete sort of falls out of the movement. We don't really know what happened to him. You know, we don't know what became of him, but from then on, there's not so much kind of active Black participation in the movement, at least for a number of years. Lamanites, like I said, become less of a theme of the movement. There are still occasional outbursts of Lamanite tongues here or there, but the dominant interpretation of tongues from then on is that it's the Adamic language that Adam and Eve spoke in the Garden of Eden. And so I think that, and also, you know, tongues and these manifestations are always subjected to the approval of authorities. So if Joseph Smith and the other ordained church authorities say that your charismatic manifestation is not of God, then you have to accept that. And so they provide themselves a way to reinforce the hierarchy of the church and potentially also the patriarchal gender hierarchy and the racial hierarchy of whites over other races. And so these charismatic gifts become less disruptive. They have less of that sort of social leveling effect thereafter. And in some ways, they become a conservative force because the hierarchy, the existing established social order, now controls these charismatic manifestations and controls who's authorized to participate in them.
So with John Whitmer's pearl clutching aside, it's a valid dilemma, and it's one that Joseph Smith was forced to address. Can there be a legitimate place for spiritual gifts sitting in the pew along with the hierarchy? It's an ongoing problem. It's a paradox that would continue to plague Mormon leaders for generations, especially if the ladies wanted in. Can you even imagine?
Luckily for us, we have the Lord talking to Joseph Smith in a revelation, giving us some more teasers. In June of 1831, here's what a revelation told Joseph Smith, quote, "Verily I say unto you, let my servants Joseph and Sidney take their journey as soon as preparations can be made to leave their homes and journey to the land of Missouri, and inasmuch as they are faithful unto me, it shall be made known unto them what they shall do, and it shall also, inasmuch as they are faithful, be made known unto them the land of your inheritance." Okay, so this is serious business now. Folks are finally going to learn where the New Jerusalem is. This is something that was permeating Christianity at the time. It still is. Where do we get to build our new Zion? And yet Joseph Smith is suddenly receiving revelations saying, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming, wait for it. As teasers go, this one lost a lot of its thunder because it's clear by this point it will be in Missouri. Just kind of a letdown. It's like when you're an LDS missionary and you open up your papers and it says Boise, Idaho. No offense, Boise, Idaho, you're great. No one from Utah wants to go there. Kind of the same thing. Really? Zion in Missouri? That's where we're going? The group arrives on July 14th, 6 days later. So they were committed to the idea. They'll go where they want you to go, dear Lord. The first revelation is given in Missouri. In his 1838 history, Joseph Smith remembered having several questions in mind when they arrived. Quote, "When will the wilderness blossom as the rose? When will Zion be built up in her glory, and where will thy temple stand unto which all nations shall come in the last days?" End quote. Remember that at this point, Jackson County is the absolute end of white civilization. It stretches beyond, it's as far as, I guess, white settler imagination can go. And so this is where the New Jerusalem is going to be built. The land west held all sorts of exotic allure. They were in the land of the Lamanites. And somewhere, they all had to have reverted to being 8 years old and going on an adventure to some degree. They're like the new Indiana Jones of religion. This revelation finally laid out some specifics. It said, quote, "Wherefore, this is the land of the promise and the place for the city of Zion. Yea, thus saith the Lord your God, if ye will receive wisdom, here is wisdom. Behold, the place which is now called Independence is the center place, and the spot for the temple is lying westward upon a lot which is not far from the courthouse." So God was getting pretty specific.
This revelation set a lot in motion, but not in an ultimately satisfying way. On the one hand, this is Zion, the New Jerusalem. That was in all caps, by the way. These new Mormons all have some cultural baggage that's associated with the term Zion. They bring it from all these diverse religious backgrounds. Added to this were all these various teasers from the revelations. I mean, this is the land of milk and honey. This is something to get excited about. However, it's a conflicting math problem in the end. Zion plus the New Jerusalem minus Joseph Smith minus church headquarters equals what exactly? So in this metaphorical balance of where to live, what outweighs what? It's a difficult decision to make. Some people heard the siren call of Zion and take off immediately. That's all they needed. For others, the decision wasn't really difficult because Joseph Smith made the decision for them. Remember when we talked about the Colesville branch, kind of how they had their own identity? After they arrived in Ohio, they intended to settle en masse on the farm owned by convert Lehman Copley. After that broke down, when they were there, they were definitely not family. We'll talk more about them. This entire branch just gets revelated down to Missouri.
So this is basically it. This is the story of how Mormonism started in New York, but migrated elsewhere. And it starts to get a little bit out of control. This is a hierarchical problem now. You have a group. You're sending out missionaries. Now you got branches everywhere. And the Lord wants you to go to the New Jerusalem, which is in Missouri. Various settlements began to develop in the wilderness of Missouri. We have talked about a lot of these dynamics on the podcast. This is where the conflict with the Hewlett branch and Sally Crandall seeing eyes and, you know, revelating, talking in tongues and Lamanites and people's hearts comes in. You have all these spiritual gifts from all of these rogue religious communities coming in, and now all of a sudden they're Mormons. With 800 miles separating the relative civilization of Kirtland and the frontier of Missouri, church governance becomes really tricky. Revelations are all well and good, but they take weeks to arrive via tired and probably resentful horses. They don't always solve the problem. Over the next troublesome and chaotic 7 years, Mormonism would be split into a headquarters group in Ohio and occasionally rebellious outpost in Missouri. This is messy stuff. The origins of this church are super messy. Finally, in 1838, Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon packed up and skipped town. Missouri was no longer safe for them. Keep that list of 3 reasons why Mormon left New York in your pocket, because it will come back to haunt Joseph Smith. Lord have mercy, let that ghost train
pass me. Curse its rails to the wind. All right, you've been waiting patiently. Books of Mormon report for today. Our book today is Joseph Smith, The Making of a Prophet by Dan Vogel. So if you've heard of Dan Vogel and know anything about his reputation, Dan is a primary sources guy. Dan is insistent on going to the documents of the time to tell the story, which is a great idea. He put together a 5-volume set called Early Mormon Documents, which was the basis not only for this book of his that we're talking about, but a lot of other things too. So in his book, it acts as part psychobiography, part history, and does a great job of discussing the first few years of Mormon history using sources that may not be familiar to a lot of people. Definitely worth your time to check out.
And before we let you go, I just want to put a reminder in all of your ears. Mark your calendars for the Sunstone Summer Symposium happening at the end of July. We always have a big, huge Mormon conference at the end of July, and this year it's July 31st through August 2nd in Sandy, Utah at the Mountain America Expo Center. We're having over 150 presentations on everything you can think about in Mormonism. All the Mormon scholars you've always studied and wanted to meet will be there, and you can come too. Register online at sunstone.org.
As always, Benchmark Books will be there with the table. We'll have a lot of these books that we talk about on this podcast, as well as many others, so come check us out there.